RNC misses Jacksonville but kicks off in Charlotte and Washington. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll review night one of the Republican National Convention, plus a look at Florida's importance this election. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a local letter carrier speaks out about the crisis at the U.S. Postal Service. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Florida added 72 deaths from the coronavirus pandemic in their Monday daily report. Good news, though, the number of new cases and tests both decreased significantly. The newly reported deaths raised the statewide toll from COVID to 10,534. There are also four new confirmed cases of the virus in Duval County Public Schools this week. Now, those are reported as a judge yesterday granted Florida teachers a temporary injunction in their lawsuit against going back into classrooms 5 days a week. That could result in some changes in some school districts around the area when it comes to in-person versus virtual class. Amidst all of this, the first day of the Republican National Convention kicked off Monday with a number of prominent Florida residents playing important roles, none bigger than President Trump himself. Remember, his official residence is in Palm Beach County. Now, Republicans didn't get to have their convention here in Jacksonville, as they had hoped. But Florida will still be a big focus from the speakers to the target audience during this biggest event to date of the president's reelection campaign. Our political analyst Matt Corrigan watched some of the RNC last night, and he's on the line now. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
Good to have you back on the show. Matt is now a dean of students or a dean of liberal arts. I'm getting your title wrong at Jacksonville University.
That's fine.
And you can follow Matt at Prof Politics on Twitter. All right. You know, most people watching the RNC last night were taking it in from around the country. Here in Jacksonville, there was an extra layer, of course, because this was an event that almost happened here, Matt. What are your thoughts about that as you watch the first night of speakers?
Well, I think we're in a brave new world of political conventions. I'm not sure how impactful they're going to be, just because, number one, at least on the Democratic side, the viewership was down some, so we'll have to see what the Republican numbers bring. And, you know, they're not speaking to a crowd, so I think that takes away something from it. And, you know, at the end of the day, the coverage of it was interesting. For example, Fox News did not cover, you know, gavel to gavel. They kept breaking in and breaking out, and there were some complaints from a lot of people on the right and some conservatives who said, you know, Fox News should be covering the whole thing. And so it's the question is, how much impact do these new types of conventions have?
Right. It's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts on the RNC and the presidential race. Right. And so we saw different approaches from the Democrats versus the Republicans and how they staged a somewhat virtual convention. And it's not the kind of spectacle we're used to watching. What were your thoughts about the Florida Republicans the Trump campaign tapped to deliver his message, like Congressman Matt Gaetz from the Panhandle? Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez is going to speak, along with former Attorney General Pam Bondi. However, Governor Ron DeSantis is not on the list of speakers this week, interestingly.
Yeah, you know, and I think the speakers are going to represent, I think, what the two themes are. Again, when you have Donald Trump involved, and Donald Trump's going to run the show, and so you may not have that consistent message that you would have in a so-called normal convention. But Representative Gaetz really took the pessimistic view, you know, that if Democrats get elected, Armageddon is headed our way, basically. And then you had other speakers later in the night, you know, Tim Scott and Nikki Haley try to, you know, have a more optimistic outlook and inclusive outlook. And so the question is, which one's going to win out, and can you have two messages?
Right. Now, let's talk about this through the prism of Florida polling. The Real Clear Politics average of Florida polls has Joe Biden up by 5 points among likely voters this November. President Trump hasn't led in a Florida poll since March. That's when the coronavirus began ravaging this state. His path to reelection runs through Florida, though. He is very unlikely to win the election unless he can carry the state of Florida. So how his convention message lands with Florida voters is critical. And the majority of Floridians, according to the polling, believe the president has done a poor job responding to the pandemic. So you didn't see a lot of focus on the pandemic last night. There was a lot of talk about jobs and the economy and cracking down on Black Lives Matter protests around the country. How likely do you think that message is to resonate with the voters in Florida, particularly the one-third of voters in this state who vote independent, that could be decisive in whether this state swings for Biden or goes for Trump?
Yeah, you know, I think that's the question. You know, are these conventions, especially on the Republican side, is it to rev up the base, which, you know, he has a strong connection with on his side, or is it to reach out to swing voters, independent voters? And most of the first night was clearly to the base. And so the question is, how do you go get some of those swing voters? And even with his base in Florida, he has an issue with COVID because seniors are being affected by this, you know, more than anyone. And so if his ratings on COVID are not good, that cuts into his senior vote, which is actually, you know, very critical. And of course, you know, he was underestimated last time. And so I don't think Democrats or analysts should underestimate his reelection. He's got Susie Wiles running Florida election again, you know, she's got a pretty good record. And so I think this race will tighten. But at the end of the day, and I know it's a cliche, but it's just so true, what's the turnout look like? Is it, you know, a huge turnout among seniors like there normally is, with no countervailing turnout among young people and in some minority groups? Or, you know, is it, you know, looking like a 2016, or is it a completely different election and electorate in 2020? That is the real question, and that will determine whether he wins Florida or not.
And added into that, Matt, the additional wrinkle of mail-in voting by mail, and how that plays out. Of course, the president has started encouraging voting by mail in Florida after initially criticizing it. In the primary, we saw the other day that there was robust Democratic turnout here across the state in the August primary. And more Democrats voted by mail this primary than they had in the past. Typically, you see more Republicans voting by mail, but the pandemic and maybe the criticisms from the president as he's tried to discredit mail-in voting, that may have made had an impact in these patterns.
Yeah, the messaging on that is a mess. Because, you know, he's tried to make a difference between mail-in voting and so-called absentee voting. They're really not different. I mean, some states, you have to have a reason to do a mail-in vote. Florida, we've done away with that. Florida's become pretty good at mail-in voting, and that's really a reaction to the year 2000 debacle, that, you know, we want to make it more easier and more efficient to vote than having long lines on election day. And through early voting and mail-in voting, we've really accomplished that. You know, we had a good election on the primary night. You know, it was well run. And so Republicans need mail-in votes here in Florida. It's been an important part of what they do. You know, they usually win the mail-in vote, and they usually win the election day vote when people come out to vote. And so, you know, I think, again, Susie Wiles has tried to, you know, come up with a new message to be clear that mail-in voting is good in Florida, but it's tough to say, well, mail-in voting is great in Florida, but everywhere else it's a disaster. That's tough messaging.
Let's go to your calls. We're talking about Florida's importance in the presidential election after night one of the Republican National Convention. Of course, it was initially going to happen in Jacksonville, this after the president moved it out of Charlotte and then ended up back in Charlotte because of his campaign's insistence on ignoring coronavirus restrictions. But in the end, the campaign had to adhere to those restrictions, and the event did not take place in Jacksonville. Let's go to your thoughts. 549-2937. Scott in Orange Park. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. There's a couple quick points. The first one is that no matter what you do with the Republican base, they're not, you know, all this, all the Trump is trying to do is drive out his radicals, his fringe, which is basically his base. In 2016, you know, Hillary had really disenfranchised, and the DNC disenfranchised and wronged Sanders. And what happened was the Democrats turned their back on him. Not so with a Republican mindset. They could blatantly, these leaders in the Republican and the GOP could blatantly violate ethics, violate the general consensus of what morality is for the party, and they still rally behind them.
And by your comments, I'm assuming you were a Bernie Sanders supporter, Scott?
Yes, I was and still am a Sanders supporter, but I am more so seeing it as it is a polarized thing. It is an A or B. People will try and bring up a third party candidate. They'll try the people who were Sanders supporters are so butthurt at the base going for Biden, who they know, who has a good track record, that
Bernie Sanders appeared at the DNC and urged all of his supporters to vote for Joe Biden. So what are your thoughts about the division that Matt
you'll
mentioned on
people,
the Republican side?
People.
This whole the base of the Republican Party is now populist and authoritarian. You saw that reflected in the comments, particularly by Donald Trump Jr. As Matt pointed out, the former governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, tried to speak to a more traditionalist strain of the Republican Party. And so those two strains were both on view last night. What's that?
They're parading people like the McCloskeys and the one kid that had the MAGA hat. You know, they're parading this. And I just recently looked at an old Encyclopedia Britannica film from 1946 on despotism. To look up 1946 ED films, despotism. You know, this film pops up. It's 12 minutes long. It's one of the ones that they used to show in schools. And it warns exactly how despots rise. And we knew that because we watched it happen with Mussolini, you know, the generations before us, and they watched it happen with Hitler. We're watching it happen right in our own country. The people that it happens to are oblivious to that. They don't care. There are people who are like,
all right, Scott.
You know, there's people
and
who follow
I take your point, Scott. I just want to get Matt to react to them, and I appreciate the call. Matt Corrigan over at JU, certainly opponents of President Trump, which include large ranks of Republicans now, by the way, many of whom have worked in his administration at one point, have warned publicly against a second term for this president, saying that he does have authoritarian tendencies and that he is a danger to our system of government. This is a commonly voiced anxiety you hear among opponents of this administration. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think the president really treasures separation of powers. And of course, that's, you know, really the basis of what our government is founded upon. You know, we revolted against a monarch, a king. And if you go back and read the Declaration of Independence, you know, there's probably over 20 direct arguments against the king. And so, I think that's an important a point and a thread that runs through American democracy. And clearly, President Trump has tried to expand his power and in some cases has been very successful. And it's been a bit surprising those in Congress haven't stood up a little bit more to some of these violations of separation of powers.
Well, what about the fact that you don't see any senators appearing this week? Republican senators at the Republican National Convention. That's really remarkable. They've distanced themselves from this event.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of them are doing it for their own political benefit, and others weren't invited.
Although, yeah, apparently Mitch McConnell may appear Thursday. I just wanted to correct myself. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, and, you know, I think they're trying to make this an outsider, but it's tough to be. And again, when the Republicans talk about, at the convention, talk about, you know, what rough shape the world would be in if Joe Biden got elected, well, it's tough to make that argument when you're the incumbent, especially during a pandemic and during a season of protest. And so that's a hard argument to make. And again, but I do think it's a legitimate comment to say that if President Trump gets reelected, you know, he's not going to have much really to hold him back to try to expand executive authority even more.
Alex in St. Augustine. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess this is all new to me. I just became a U.S. citizen in 2018.
Oh, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I lived in the U.S. for like 30 years. I came here when I was five. And initially, I'm actually a DREAM Act person, but I was able to become a U.S. citizen because I came in a visa and I was able to change my status. Long story, but this is my first election. And I've been in the U.S. to go through the Bush, senior Bush presidency, the Clinton presidency, George Bush Jr. and Obama, and I've never seen things like this crazy before. I can't say I'm a liberal or like a conservative. I mean, I like to be a centrist, and I do believe that, yeah, we need border security and all that, but I just don't think Donald Trump is like the right person to run this country because, the deal breaker for me was the fact that white supremacists do support him. I mean, you can't lie about that. They do support him. Even though he says that he doesn't support him, it's like, come on, it's like the guy is supported by those kind of people. And, I mean, we're a country of many colors, many religions, and to me, it just scares the heck out of me that if this guy gets reelected, I mean, he's even pondering, like, bringing some kind of totalitarianism into this country. And I don't know, it's just, it's heartbreaking for me just growing up because I love this country. This is my country. Just to see it going down this way, and I don't know. I mean, it's definitely going to be scary, and I mean, for sure, I'm going to be voting for Biden, even though I think Biden is not the perfect candidate. And I know a lot of the Democrats and a lot of like left-wing liberals, like they think, oh, he's not perfect. But I think it's better than what we have now.
Okay, Alex.
For certain. I think it. Oh,
all right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Okay. Matt Corrigan, you know, whether you embrace multiracial democracy or you are dismayed by the demographic and social changes and sometimes social unrest happening in this country right now is a pretty good indicator of how you will vote in November. And I think Alex gets right to the heart of what's going on in this election. And so, you know, the question is, the negative partisanship is going to drive this election. As Alex said, he's not necessarily crazy about Joe Biden, but he's more motivated to vote against the incumbent, Donald Trump. You know, the question anyone who follows politics has is, will that drive more of Biden's voters to the polls, or will the president be able to foment enough anxiety about these demographic changes to drive more of his supporters to the polls?
Yeah, and the answer may be both. I mean, I think we're going to have a very high turnout election, and what the Democrats have on their side, at least as of now, is they have a candidate with a higher favorability rating than Donald Trump. Whereas when you had Donald Trump and Secretary Clinton running, they both had really bad favorability ratings. And so, you know, at least as of now, that's a Democratic advantage. Now, as the Republicans move to define Joe Biden over the next couple of months, that may change. Again, a problem with that is when you have Donald Trump, who likes to talk about himself a lot, you know, you don't have as much time to frame the other person. And so we'll see how they balance that. And actually, with COVID and all of the crises that have happened over the last couple of months, Republicans really haven't had or have not defined Joe Biden as much as, you know, previous challengers have been defined. If you go back and think about Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama, he was defined through the summer of 2012. Same with John Kerry in 2004. He was defined. Really hasn't happened. I mean, of course, they tried to do that earlier, but really hasn't happened this summer. And so the question is, clearly this is a referendum on Donald Trump. Can they turn the attention to Joe Biden in terms of their strategy? We'll see.
And a listener reminds me, Senator Tim Scott did speak last night at the RNC. So one senator did appear last night. Thank you for correcting me there. We may still see Senator Mitch McConnell speak this week. Matthew in Avondale. Hi, Matthew. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. I watched the entire program last night, mostly through gritted teeth. I was really kind of confused at the messages. We were told the theme was the promise of America, this uplifting kind of slogan, and we got fear for 2 hours, literally screaming in our faces for some of it. They had Kimberly Guilfoyle out there, who was the angriest Evita I have ever seen. And I think the messaging was so turned around on itself. You literally had the gentleman whose daughter was killed in Parkland, and then the next people were the couple waving their guns at the Black Lives Matter protesters, saying how wonderful it was that anyone can own a gun in this country and use it. And I thought that was such dissonance to watch that. And then to have, there was an older gentleman from Miami, a Cuban, who came and spoke about how awful it was in his country and how he would do anything to get into the United States because of its promise. And I think that completely belies this very hard stance on immigration, where you rip children away from their families for the effect of fear. I don't really know what they were getting at, except probably what we've been getting for 4 years, in my opinion, is to scare the hell out of us. I don't think it's working. Reality shows.
All right, Matthew, and I thank you for that. And I ask everyone to watch their language on this program. Thank you, Matthew. Okay, Matt Corrigan. Certainly, millions of people watched last night, and many of them agreed with Matthew. They recoiled from the message that the Republicans gave. Now, that said, following the conversation on social media last night was a reflection of how divided we are as a country. Because while millions of Americans were very turned off, millions of Americans were also thrilling to the message that was on television. And I think it just speaks to the two Americas we live in. Your political belief system is almost like a tribal religious thing now for so many Americans. And people that were turned off by the Republican convention are just in a completely different universe than people who thought it was great.
Yeah, don't underestimate the argument of chaos and riots, etc. It worked in 1968 for Richard Nixon in lots of ways. It's a clear argument that if you go this way, that we're going to have chaos in our society. That's a clear message. The only you obviously could argue about the factual basis of that, but the message is clear. My comment is, I don't know if Donald Trump can stay on that message for 4 months. And because right now, people know Donald Trump, and either they like him or they don't like him, and a lot of people don't like him. And so he's not going to be able to move up his favorability that much, so he's really going to have to go after Biden. Is he going to have the discipline to do that for 4 months, or does he want to talk about himself even more? And to me, that's the question. And at the end of the day, in our state especially, who turns out more? The villages turn out more, or does Southeast Florida or the Panhandle? And that's really the open question.
Always good to have your insights. He's Matt Corrigan, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at JU. I got your title right here at the end.
Thank you.
follow Matt, also the author of books about Florida politics. Follow him on Twitter @ProfPolitics. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, a local chef makes her national TV debut tonight on the Food Network. We'll have a preview, but up next.
As a carrier, you're going door to door, and they're like, my Social Security check, my disability check always comes on this day. Like, do you know where my check is? And I'm getting that more now than ever.
A letter carrier in Jacksonville speaks out about the crisis inside the U.S. Postal Service. We'll be right back.
It's presidential campaign season. Donald Trump is doubling down on appealing to just his base and hoping everyone else stays home.
They're putting out messaging and advertising and conspiracy theories and misinformation designed to confuse and disorient the electorate.
Political writer McKay Coppins on the Trump campaign. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday at noon here on WJCT News 89.9.
Snap judgment means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy defended his management of the U.S. Postal Service to the House of Representatives Monday. He spoke amid growing concerns that his cost-cutting measures at the post office have jeopardized the agency's ability to serve all Americans and get the mail out on time. Now, letter carriers have been ordered by DeJoy not to speak to the media about the problems at the Postal Service. We spoke with one anyway. This carrier is not identifying herself, but we can tell you that she works in Jacksonville as a part-time junior carrier CCA, or Customer Carrier Associate. Although part-time is not an accurate designation right now, she says they're all working at least 60 hours a week to get the mail out to the public. Here's what she told us about problems with mail delivery here in Northeast Florida. Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Yes, no problem. Thank you.
So you're a letter carrier in Jacksonville. Your official designation is CCA. Basically, under the terms of the government's classifications, you're a part-time letter carrier, a junior letter carrier. But in this crisis, it's my understanding you've been working full-time. Is that right?
Yeah, we've always been working full-time before the crisis. But after the crisis, it's gotten into... last summer, we would work probably 40 to 50 hours a week, but during this crisis, it's probably closer to 60 to 70.
60 to 70 hours a week. And what is going on with the mail that you're observing that is requiring you to work this many hours?
One, the post office still operates on letter mail, so they measure time by how much letter mail you have. In the morning, the supervisor will come to you and say, you have this many units of mail. What they don't look at is the level of packages that we have, and we're basically running Christmas-level packages during COVID in 110-degree heat, and even if the mail is down, that number of packages increases your day significantly.
And is it, are people sending more packages or what is happening?
I think it's ordering online. I think the online ordering has significantly increased. Everybody's ordering everything. The amount of diapers I deliver, the basic essential things that people were used to run to the store for are now being delivered to their house.
I see. So in this time of pandemic, we need the Postal Service now more than ever. And so what changes are you observing with the cuts to overtime and the changes that have been made with the leadership of the Postal Service? How is that trickling down to you on your routes in Jacksonville?
Well, the cuts to overtime, the manager came and they said, we're going to cut overtime. And that week I worked 70 hours. So we kind of see the cuts of overtime at the CCA position, especially, as not something that's real. It's almost like we're pretending we're cutting overtime. But it's not something that's happened in my experience. Like I said, last summer, probably about 20% of the station would work overtime. This summer, probably about two Saturdays ago, I'm standing in the parking lot of a post office at 8:30 at night, and there's three trucks. And you're just like, yeah, they cut overtime. Hmm. But we're all out there, and I've never seen that except for Christmas. But it's a Saturday in August. It's pretty amazing right now working in the post office.
So you're working really hard. Now, we've heard that these sorting machines, that there's been a lot of reporting about those being removed or destroyed, and that has slowed down the mail. Has that been done in this area of Florida or not? Do you know?
I don't know. We don't have any access to the sorting machines. We get what we get every day and we deliver it. What I can say is that a lot of people know when their important mail comes. They know when the JEA bill comes. They know when their disability check comes. They know when their Social Security check comes. And as a carrier, you're going door to door and they're like, my Social Security check, my disability check always comes on this day. Like, do you know where my check is? And I'm getting that more now than ever. So I can't say from our perspective if it's being slowed down, but I can say that talking to the community, they are definitely saying it is.
Your customers at homes and apartments, they feel like their mail is being slowed down. Do you feel pressure to work more hours, to work harder, to try to keep the mail going out in a timely way?
Yes, definitely. It's weird because we all know that the post office is running on a limited budget. We know that they're trying to cut labor costs, but you can't cut labor. It doesn't change the amount of labor required to complete a job just because you want to cut costs. So if they're going to cut costs somewhere else, if they're going to cut labor somewhere else, someone else is going to have to pick up the slack. And a lot of time that falls on us, the CCAs. We do more sorting. We do delivery. We do all types of jobs.
Well, what else are you seeing that would either confirm or, I guess, deny what we're hearing about the Postal Service and the concerns about the Postal Service how it's being run?
Yeah, they implemented something called, there's certain stations that are test stations, and they implemented something called expedite to street afternoon sortation. And that was the new implementation to the post office. And what that means is, when you get there in the morning, say you show up at 8 a.m., by union requirements, we get 15-minute break. So you get there at 8 a.m., you take a 15-minute break. They want you on the street at 8:30. So you have 15 minutes to sort as much mail as you can and get it out to the street. And so that's all the mail that was missorted, or all your magazines, all your flats that gets put into this case that you have in air conditioning. And now we have 15 minutes to get as much mail as we can into the truck, where we used to have at least an hour and a half to organize all our small packages, all our mail, and bring it out to the street. That was cut. And then you get sent to the street in 15 minutes, and you're in a truck with no air conditioning, and none of your mail is sorted. You have no flats that you used to have trays of flats. You have all your machined mail, and you go out there, and you're trying now, because you couldn't sort it at the station, you're sorting it in the truck in 110 degrees, and you're bringing out less mail. So all that mail that you couldn't sort in 15 minutes is sitting at your station. And then you come back at night, and they say, sort at night. So we have to out case in the afternoon the mail that's left. Well, for a lot of us, we're not just doing our route. When some other route is not covered, we're doing an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours on some other person's route. So we're not getting back until 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night. Then they want you off the clock. So we can't have you here because if you work more than 8 hours a day, it's time and a half. If you work more than 10 hours a day, it's double time. So we got to get you off the clock. Well, then that mail is still sitting there that we never brought to the street after 15 minutes of sortation. Mm-hmm. And then the next day it continues. And then also that means is the truck that picks up the mail at the station, that comes at 7. Well, now you're after the truck. So all the mail that you picked up during the day is supposed to be delivered and on that truck that day is not on that truck. And so they used to, like last summer, they would run the mail that was got there after the truck left. They would run it downtown and get it on the truck, the last truck at night, so it would be delivered. That's not happening anymore either. So all the mail we pick up during the day, all the pickups we get, if you get back after that truck leaves, is sitting on the station floor, which is also delaying the mail.
Wow. So lots of delays. So what are letter carriers hoping Congress might be able to achieve with more funding for the Postal Service?
Hiring. We need help. We need more hiring, and we also need an updated plan on delivery. We can't just keep measuring mail on how long it'll take. We need an actual comprehensive plan to see what takes long, how long it takes, and the amount of labor required to complete the job. So we're hoping for an updated system that includes the level of packages and the decreased amount of mail. I mean, they are right. The mail has decreased, especially during COVID. And we have to deal with COVID because we're not even told when someone has COVID. Basically, someone disappears for 2 weeks, and then they're back. They say, according to HIPAA, we're not allowed to tell you, and they don't. And so every once in a while, they make an announcement like, oh, we have one new case at the station. So we don't have anybody to cover. We need more people.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing your work experience with us. It's really good information that a lot of listeners need to hear. So thank you so much.
Yep, no problem.
That was a Jax postal carrier. Well, coronavirus is exploding in Florida's prison population, killing dozens of inmates and even infecting some corrections officers. We're taking a closer look at the crisis in the COVID corrections system right now with an expert. Ellen Murray, PhD, oversaw TB programs for all correctional facilities in Florida. Let's listen.
Dr. Murray, good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for asking me. I appreciate this.
It's good to get your expertise on the spread of COVID throughout the Florida Department of Corrections. Tens of thousands of inmates are testing positive. Dozens have died. Even some corrections officials have come down with the virus. What is your professional assessment as to how this is spreading within jails and prisons, and what do you think needs to be done about it?
Well, it's going to spread because it's a congregate setting, and there's no way to get around that. It's also spreading within the community, and I know several jails have adopted many of the CDC guidelines, and prisons are now starting to adopt those guidelines very carefully, and they're looking within each particular prison. But the issue, I think, comes down to if you haven't seen it, you don't always believe that it's there, and you kind of forget. And my recommendation is be proactive. Get a hold of those CDC guidelines. They just came out as of July 22nd, and they have been doing a great job really talking to correctional representatives and looking at the coronavirus and the spread. And the guidance that they have now for correctional and detention facilities really is more in-depth than it was even with the March recommendations.
And we're hearing, anecdotally anyway, that not all prisons or jails are following the guidelines, in particular the wearing of masks. There's no real way to check that, though. We aren't typically granted access to look for ourselves.
Correct.
What are your thoughts?
Well, many facilities, if there is a large outbreak in the facility, They are legally bound to report that, of course, to the state and the local health departments. And the health departments can actually go in and, as part of their recommendation, can recommend that those people need to start wearing masks, especially staff, but even inmates. And my recommendation to several jails has been get your inmates involved in making masks so that they can all actually wear some. It won't hurt.
That's a smart idea. They need to take you up on that. Now, some Florida lawmakers have been asking the governor to consider granting compassionate release for some inmates, elderly inmates, nonviolent offenders, those with pre-existing conditions. Do you think that is a good way to go? What is your assessment of whether they should do some more compassionate release to bring down these COVID jail numbers and prison numbers?
I'm actually right on the fence with that. Because I see so many of those same people out in the community having the same issues with the deaths or the, you know, people not wearing masks around them, things like that. Sometimes I look at a facility and I'll say, you're probably safer in the facility because they're doing all the right things. Now, if the facility is not doing the right things, that's another issue. But if the facility is actually identifying those people who are at highest risk and their charges are low, yeah, I say let them go back into the community with the, you know, with the stipulation that if they're not following the procedures that are recommended in that community, you go right back to the jail or the prison. Because let's face it, if you're not going to do what's right out in the community, you need to be isolated.
Mm-hmm. And for the average Florida resident who doesn't have a connection to corrections, what would you say to them when they hear about the skyrocketing COVID cases within jails and prisons? They think, well, that doesn't really affect me because that's the population that's incarcerated.
Yeah, and it absolutely affects them every way, shape, and form because inmates, once they've served their sentence, get back out into the community. My recommendation has always been let's educate the incarcerated population because 85 to 90% are going right back to the community. And I've found that they are our biggest cohort when it comes to educating the community population. They can help with, you know, wear your mask. You're not just helping me, you're helping the rest of your family, you're helping others. So the mask really can help. And I hear so many times just the going to the grocery store when people aren't wearing a mask and my mouth goes on forever, unfortunately. I tell everybody, why aren't you wearing a mask? And they go, well, I'm not at risk. It's not that you're not at risk. You may be bringing it to someone you love.
Yeah.
Or to somebody else. And that's the whole reason for wearing the mask. You can decrease the spread of COVID just by washing your hands, keeping that 6-foot distance, and wearing a mask. And if everybody did that for, say, 2 months, we'd be rid of this
thing. We'd be done, exactly. Well, Dr. Murray, your insights are so valued, and I want to thank you for joining the show. Thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And in a moment, a local pastry chef makes her national TV debut tonight on the Food Network. We've got a preview next.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org.
I'm Marco Werman, host of The World. Our reporters are looking outside the U.S. for clues about how to live in a post-pandemic world, how restrictions are easing in some countries but still imposed in others. Each day, we watch the numbers, find the experts, and speak with people beyond our borders to see how other places are navigating the road ahead. It's the world. Join us.
Today at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Sarah Fry is the biggest producer of pumpkins in America, but when she was growing up in rural America, staying on the farm was not in her plans.
I spent my entire childhood and most of my teenage years planning and plotting my escape.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. What changed your mind? Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
It's been described as a national crisis in Canada, and it's gaining more attention in the U.S. More than 2,300 Native American women have gone missing or been killed over the last four decades. Most of those cases have never been solved. An invisible crisis in Indian country, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, set your DVR for 10 o'clock tonight. That's when local pastry chef Rebecca Reed will appear on the Food Network show Chopped Sweets. Chef Rebecca is the pastry chef for Restaurant Orsay, Black Sheep Restaurant, and Bellwether. Tonight's episode is titled Take Me to the Tropics, and we're told competitors are being given a tropical theme where they set out to send the judges on a sweet trip they won't forget. We've got a preview right now. Chef Rebecca Reed is on the line. Hey, Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great to have you. It's always great to see a local chef on the Food Network. So how were you selected?
I had filled out a general application, gosh, months ago, before even hearing anything back. And then it seemed like all of a sudden they gave me a call, asked for a phone interview, which led to another phone interview, which led to a video interview. Then I had to submit photos and a video application. The process was a little lengthy, but then I finally got cast on the show, and I found out when I would be going to New York to film.
How exciting. Now, you are a pastry chef at Orsay, Black Sheep, and Bellwether, three great local restaurants, all have the same ownership. So yes. You go up for the shoot. How was the shoot, and what were the challenges, the ingredients you had to do something with?
I know I can't disclose all the ingredients I had to work with, but the whole premise of the show is that you're given a mystery ingredient box, and you open it up, you have no idea what could be inside, and you have to cook those four ingredients into some kind of a dish that's as delicious as possible. And although I can't say exactly what it was, I will say that they do not hold anything back. You can be given large format, really big desserts, like a whole party dessert. You could have raw ingredients. When I say raw ingredients, it could be raw fruit. It could be raw meat. It could really be anything. And then you have to turn that into a dish.
Oh, man. And can you tell us how you think you did?
Well, I'm really excited, and I'm really proud that I was able to represent Jacksonville. And honestly, just getting to that level after all of the interviewing to be cast on the show really feels like an honor. So I can't say how I did, but I really hope that everybody will join in tonight. And we actually have a little Zoom watch party that's going on. So if you follow me on Facebook or Instagram, you can get all the details for that too.
Oh, that's great. Yes. And I'll repeat this again in a minute, but you can catch Rebecca, Chef Rebecca, on the Food Network tonight at 10 o'clock as she competes on Chopped Sweets. Now, all of that said, things are tough for the restaurant industry right now. How are things at Bellwether, Orsay, and Black Sheep in the kitchen and out there on the dining floor?
Things are really different. Living in a pandemic with COVID, with so many new regulations, things are just different and weird. And I wish I had a more eloquent way of saying that. But it's just, it's new. And I think in the beginning, people weren't really sure what on earth was about to be going on. and we were all given these new protocols and safety measures, and now I'm just really proud to be working with a team that's taking it seriously. We're all wearing our masks and gloves and washing our hands even more than we are used to washing our hands. And let me tell you, we wash our hands a lot to begin with. So there's some new challenges there. So I'm really excited that this episode is coming out tonight. With so many hard things happening in the restaurant industry and our daily lives right now, to be a bright spot, to offer some sweetness and to bring some joy to the city. I'm so excited, and I hope that I get to provide that.
Yes, we could all use a bright spot like this. And as you mentioned, people can follow you on Facebook, or they can check out your website too, because you do offer virtual cooking classes as well, right?
Yes, you can check me out at ChefRebeccaReed.com, and I'm also on Instagram. I'm the Baker Reed, or even Facebook, Rebecca Reed on there, and you can see what I'm up to through all of the restaurant's Facebook pages as well.
Check it out, ChefRebeccaReed.com, and tune in to the Food What Network tonight at 10 o'clock as Chef Rebecca Reed of Jacksonville, a pastry chef at Orsay, Bellwether, and Black Sheep, competes on the Food Network show Chopped Sweets. I hope you win, Rebecca. We'll be watching. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to this show and all of our guests and callers for participating. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor here at WJC News. One of those speaking things today, WJCT News. Keep those emails coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock here on this radio station, or our podcast will be up later today. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow and look forward to connecting with you then. In the meantime, have a great day. Keep socially distancing, hand washing, supporting local restaurants, and wearing your masks, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.